Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Rick returns next Sunday. This year, the University of Virginia is celebrating its 200th year since its founding. With us this morning to learn all about the founding of the university and why it's sometimes called Mr. Jefferson's University is historian Rick Britton. Rick Britton is an historian of the Old Dominion who specializes in 18th and 19th century Virginia history. His expertise includes the American Civil War and the life and times of our third president, Thomas Jefferson. Along with his writing, Rick conducts tours of Civil War battlefields, teaches classes on history in Central Virginia, organizes programming for the center in Charlottesville, illustrates maps for history books, and lectures all across Virginia on a wide range of topics. With over 200 published articles and essays under his belt, he's the author of Albemarle and Charlottesville, an Illustrated History, and Jefferson, a Monticello Sampler, for which he was awarded a medal for nonfiction at the New York City Book Expo, the nation's largest book convention. His newest book, Virginia Vignettes, Volume 1, Famous Characters and Events in Central Virginia History, is the first of a new series featuring some of the men and women who figure large in 18th and 19th century American history. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I am doing well, thank you. How are you doing?
Doing great.
So, last time you were with us, we talked a bit about your cartography work or your work in cartography.
That's right,
cartography.
In maps, yep.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you some work about your work in history. Were you always interested in history, or did that come later in life?
Now, that's a great question. Well, pretty much I've been interested in history since I've been reading. So, when I was really little, the hundredth anniversary of the Civil War came around. I was born in the 50s. And my grandmother in Richmond started buying me Civil War books about the Civil War in Virginia. And I got hooked right away. And I've been reading Virginia history pretty much ever since.
Wow. So when you research your books, I assume that some of your research has to be done on the internet.
Some of it is.
I mean, yeah. I'm sure you use scholarly sources as well, but sometimes you have to go to the internet.
Right.
How do you go about separating fact from nonsense when you're using the internet as a source?
Well, that's a loaded question, Dan, because you and I both know, and I hope most of the listeners know, that the internet is largely nonsense. So you have to be very careful. So what I do is I'm only going to use a source on the internet if I can see the sources, the reference works that author used. And then I'm going to check those. So I'll immediately go down to the end notes or the footnotes and see where the author is getting these bits and pieces of information. And I can, because I've read so much Virginia history, read so much Civil War history, I can see pretty quickly whether they're good sources or not.
Right.
Right.
So do you still use books as a source as well?
Absolutely. Mostly books.
Mostly books.
I'm like a lot of people, I'm still fairly skittish about the internet.
Yeah.
And there are times when I've found quotes on the internet and they turn out to be altered and not accurate. And so you have to be very careful.
And I'm guessing that you probably know who the respected authors are.
Not always, but if I'm going to use quotes from an author in particular, and I'm working on a Civil War piece right now, so this is, I'm glad that you asked, it's kind of fresh in my mind. I'll look up the author to find out more about the author, and sometimes even I'm using a number of books right now, a number of biographies that are fairly old. I go back and I find reviews from the 1940s of these biographies to see if they're well respected or not.
Sure.
You have to be careful.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you use local newspapers of the time?
Sometimes, and they're really important because they're primary sources being things close in time to the event. And sometimes they're really good, but I find that they're best for flamboyant and exaggerations. So sometimes they make for fun reading, because then you can say, well, obviously that's what they said at the time, but it's not true.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
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 So we're here this morning to talk about the founding of Mr. Jefferson's University, a.k.a. the University of Virginia,
right,
which was founded 200 years ago this year.
Right.
It sounds like Jefferson had an interest in public education for some time before this.
He really did. And the part of that story that I think is the most fascinating is, of course, it didn't exist when he was growing up. So there was no public education in Virginia. The education was just for the well-to-do and the families who could afford private tutors for their kids, or private school teachers for their children and the children of their neighbors. In general, until Jefferson and some others in Virginia come along, in general, it was pretty much okay for all the kids in Virginia to learn how to grow tobacco.
Right,
that's
right.
Pretty much all they needed to know.
And how did Jefferson come to settle here? I mean, he could have settled anywhere, and we would not have the University of Virginia.
That's true.
It wouldn't be here.
That's true. Well, Jefferson's born here, of course.
Right.
He's born at Shadwell, which was his father's plantation, in 1743. And at the time, Shadwell and this whole area that we're in right now, Charlottesville, was part of Goochland County. Charlottesville, of course, didn't exist yet, but this whole area was part of Goochland County, which starts back then just west of Richmond and went all the way to the Blue Ridge Mountains, a massive county.
Now, Jefferson was, education was very important to Jefferson. If anybody who's been through Monticello would know.
Oh, my gosh.
That books and
knowledge is power. Knowledge is happiness.
That's right. In fact, isn't the founding of the university one of the three things that are on his tombstone?
That's right. So of all the different things, and we should probably do a show in the future of all the amazing things. You know, we'd probably have to do a series of 20 or 30 shows.
Right.
All the amazing accomplishments of Thomas Jefferson. Of all the things that he did, he only wanted three inscribed on his tombstone: that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, and that he was the father of the University of Virginia. Three of the ideals that he holds most dear: personal freedom, religious freedom, education.
Right. Talk about Jefferson's own education.
So when he's really little, he's tutored. So beginning at the age of five, and just think about this, listeners out there, he starts learning Greek and Latin. Imagine five-year-olds nowadays, being taught Greek and Latin. Then he goes to a private school, and then, of course, he attends William and Mary, where he had an amazing professor. It was an Enlightenment man that really Jefferson claimed in his autobiography years later, that he wrote in his retirement years, that this man expanded his knowledge, just kind of opened his mind. And then, of course, he read the law under one of the finest law scholars in the colonies at the time, George Wythe, who becomes a personal friend for the rest of his life. And then, of course, he gets a chance to meet the royal governor. And what's incredible is that these three well-educated men that I'm just mentioning, they would oftentimes have dinner, and they would invite the 17-year-old Thomas Jefferson to dine with them and to play music with them. And that one anecdote speaks volumes of what the 17-year-old Jefferson must have been like.
Wow. Amazing.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, smart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Really, really smart.
Yeah.
Very mature for his age. Just a brilliant kid at 17.
When Jefferson talks about public education, he's not talking about public in the same way we use it.
Right.
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 We're talking about white landowners, basically?
Yeah. He's talking about public education for all white males. So even the boys of those tobacco farmers, he is talking about public education for them, who he's not including here in Virginia at the time. Sadly, he's not including women, as you probably already guessed. And of course, he's not including African Americans, and he's not including Native Americans. But it's more public than had existed prior.
Right.
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 But in fact, women weren't allowed to register as undergraduates at the University of Virginia till 1970s, I think.
1970. But there were always female students at the university because you had, in the medical school, you had nurses. And then there was always a special program that was called Faculty Daughters. So a professor who had daughters, the daughters could audit classes. Now, they're not going to get credits, but they're going to audit those. And so that's an advantage. So sadly, yes, women were not included.
Right.
Right.
Historian Rick Britton here in our studio this morning. We're talking about the founding of the University of Virginia as it celebrates its 200th anniversary this year. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I wonder if you could take us back to Jefferson's earliest push for education when he was a state delegate, a Virginia state delegate.
Yeah, so this is during the Revolution, and of course, once we break away from the mother country, one of the first things, and it was actually more interesting to Jefferson to do this than it was to work on the Declaration of Independence.
Really?
Yeah, is the new Constitution for the state of Virginia. So he does a number of things that are pretty revolutionary, pretty radical. And one is to suggest public education for all the boys in Virginia, elementary schools, basically, and then a plan. And I'm really fascinated by this because I think we're coming back around to this idea. At a certain age, he broke up everybody into two classes, laboring and learned. And for the laboring classes, he believes that they only need a certain amount of education. And so once they learn mathematics, once they learn language and certain things, grammar, then they can go back into trades. But then the other ones who are going to become scholars, who are going to become professors, who are going to become religious leaders, they go on and study the sciences to their highest degree. So what I'm saying is that I think we're coming back now to the idea that not everybody needs to go to college and that there are lots of worthwhile trades that we're always going to need. We're always going to need auto mechanics. We're always going to need computer technicians. We're always going to need bricklayers. We're always going to need plumbers. Most of these people make a whole lot more money than I do or ever will. And there's no shame in those wonderful trades. Those are people we need in our society. So obviously, not everybody needs to go to college.
Yeah, that's very interesting because, as you said, that's an idea we're starting to work back toward now, which Jefferson had.
He understood back then.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that something?
So Jefferson was a delegate as a younger man.
Yes.
Right? So
yeah.
So quite a lot of
time. He's in his early 30s.
Quite a lot of time has passed between this, what we're just talking about as a delegate, and when he would seriously start to think about starting the university.
Right, but he's got this plan that he worked on. It's one of his babies, and it's not adopted.
Right.
It's too radical. What, educate everybody? Are you crazy? It's just way too radical. So, you know, he has all of these things, and for everything that we know that he accomplished, Jefferson had dozens and dozens of other plans that he hadn't accomplished. And so this kind of lingers, and I see it as kind of a frustration to him that it wasn't adopted.
Let's move on and talk about the kind of the seedlings of...
Seedlings, that's great.
Seedlings of University of Virginia, Albemarle Academy.
Albemarle Academy.
Yeah. What do we know about it?
So in the first decade of the 1800s, there was a committee that was working on this this idea, and it's basically what we would call, I imagine, a prep school today, a secondary school, Albemarle Academy. We don't have a lot of information about it. We've got a few notes. When Jefferson retires from the presidency in 1809, and of course he spent the rest of his life, 17 years, here in Albemarle County at Monticello, he's invited to become a member of this committee. And then they put him on a subcommittee that's tasked with drafting up a plan as to what Albemarle Academy is going to be. So if anybody remembers one thing that I say about Thomas Jefferson, I would have the listener remember this. He was an amazing dreamer. His thoughts are always up in the clouds, and he dreamt big. Have no small dreams. It applies to Thomas Jefferson. Why should you not have small dreams? Well, what if they come true? Now you've got a small life. Dream big. Dream big.
Why not, right?
Have big dreams. And so Jefferson is chosen to draft this document. And so he says, well, why do we want this this academy when we can have a college? And why not aim for having the best college that befits the largest, the most populous state in the Union? Let's have the best. And why not have it right here? And why not do it right now? And, you know, I see the rest of the guys who are involved in this. They're kind of flabbergasted. But you have to think, who's going to argue with Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, two-term president of the United States, doubles the size of the nation during his first term as president? He's not the kind of guy that you just argue with. When he has a point of view, you can bet your bottom dollar that he has 10 times more information than you do.
Right.
So who's going
to... And a plan.
And a plan. Who's going to argue with him?
Yeah, really.
So begrudgingly, they go, oh, okay.
So where was the academy located?
So it never happened.
Oh.
So the plan then gets the approval of the state legislature, and that morphs into the next seedling, Central College.
All right. And we're going to talk about that right after the break. But I wanted to ask you what Jefferson meant by the useful sciences.
That's a great question. To him, so many things were, he's fascinated by everything, but he finds the most use. He's very utilitarian in certain things. So let me give you an example. So he's an early meteorologist. But his idea of gathering meteorological information twice a day, starting on the 4th of July, 1776, for the rest of his life, with just a few easily understood lapses, twice a day he's recording meteorological. But here's a perfect example of a useful science. Why is he doing this? He's doing this so that the local farmers, if he gathers enough information years and years, they're going to know the best time to plant this, the best time to harvest this. So it's very utilitarian. So there is a perfect example of one of Jefferson's useful sciences.
So he was a very applied science kind of guy.
Applied science,
right.
Absolutely.
And really, if you ever walk through Monticello, you can see that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Especially where they cut the hole in the floor for the cord from the clock.
Oh, yeah. Well, that clock had been designed for another home in Philadelphia.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And so when he brings, so this is another part of the story that is not often told. So when it's brought down here, there's not enough room on the walls for the cannonball weights that actually power the gong,
right,
and power the clock itself. What's fascinating about this is I always had this impression, and I worked at Monticello for a dozen years, and then one day there were some engineers there, and we asked, and you can relate to this, Dan, we asked the engineers, if Jefferson just used his brain a little bit, do you think he could have come up a way with like pulleys to keep the cannonball weights on the wall? And the engineer took a look and studied it for maybe 5 minutes and said, absolutely, he could have.
Huh. So, in other words,
probably it was like, oh, okay, let's just do this. He didn't want to spend his time trying to figure out.
Well, that's what practical people do.
That's what practical people do.
I mean, they solve the problem and then they move on to the next.
And they move on.
Move on to the next problem.
Right.
Right. Historian Rick Britton here in our studio this morning. We are talking about the founding of the University of Virginia as it celebrates its 200th anniversary this year. You are listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. After the break, we'll learn all about Central College and how it eventually led to the University of Virginia. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. We're back with Rick Britton in our Hillsdale Drive studios talking about Mr. Jefferson's University, a.k.a. the University of Virginia. I gave you a little teaser just before the break there. We're going to talk about Central College. So when was it established? Tell us the story of Central College.
So Central College is the next iteration, or the next seedling, as you so aptly put, after Albemarle Academy. So the plan that Jefferson came up with for something much more grandiose here in our area becomes known as Central College, and they get a generous endowment, $40-some thousand. They're able to tap into part of the literary fund that's given to them by the state legislature, and they actually start building. So it's kind of fascinating that the first buildings at the University of Virginia, and the cornerstone laying for the very first one, was in October of 1817, and that's Pavilion Number 7 on the West Lawn. When those first buildings are going up, they're not for an institution named the University of Virginia. They're for an institution named Central College.
And does that building survive?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So a good number of the original buildings were erected as part of Central College, not as a part of the University of Virginia.
Wow.
And then that morphs into the University of Virginia later on.
Right.
Right.
Talk about Jefferson's hands-on approach to
oh
building.
Oh, my gosh.
The building the college.
Oh, my gosh. That's just putting it mildly. So the listener needs to remember that at this point in his life, we're talking about the 18-teens until the mid-1820s. Jefferson's already in his 70s. Jefferson went after this thing with a passion that belies his 70-plus years. So he actually laid off the grounds personally for the lawn. I mean, I'm talking about with little sticks and twine and a hammer.
Wow.
He and a personal servant, Reed Slave, he laid that off personally once they'd acquired the land. He designed all the original buildings of the University of Virginia, all the lawn buildings, all the range buildings, and one that no longer exists, the Anatomical Theater. It was torn down in the 1930s to make way for Alderman Library. So almost all of Jefferson's designed buildings still stand around the lawn and on the ranges. He designed the curriculum. He wrote out by hand a list of 6,000 volumes that comprised the first library of the University of Virginia. He goes after everything with a hands-on approach. Just an amazing man.
Wow. And at age 70, what did you say, age 70?
70 plus.
70
he's in
plus?
His mid, in some of the stuff that's going on, he's in his mid to late 70s.
And this is not 70 plus in our sense of what
exactly
it is.
Exactly right.
That's a pretty good age for.
Exactly right. Nowadays, 70
right?
is like the new 50.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jefferson lived to be, Jefferson passed away when he was 83 years old. And I enjoy telling people that 83 years old in Jefferson's time is more like 103 today. It was a lot older. 83 was old. 70 plus was old in Jefferson's lifetime.
Right. Do we know Jefferson to be a fit man at that time?
Oh, yeah. He's a fit guy. Later on, in his last couple of years, he suffers from a lot of ailments. But generally, he's fit. I mean, he kept himself thin. He believed in daily exercise. He ate very little meat. Early on, even though he's making most of his money growing tobacco, he refuses to use any tobacco products. Think about that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eats mostly vegetables. Pretty healthy guy.
So who did Central College have a board of visitors?
Right. So,
and who were some of the luminaries, we'll say, on the original?
Oh, my gosh. So Jefferson becomes the rector, which would be the equivalent of president. He's the rector. Two of the other members are people you might have heard of, James Madison and James Monroe.
Right. Right.
I don't think, and if the listeners know of another situation like this, contact me on the internet and let me know. I don't think any other university in the United States was founded by three presidents of the United States.
Wow.
And then on top of that, there's John Hartwell Cocke, who had been a brigadier general in the War of 1812, and Joseph Carrington Campbell. And there's a few others that are not quite as important. Cocke is really important because he put his monies and his expertise in building into the University of Virginia. Cocke took over the construction of the rotunda when Jefferson passed away. So he actually completes the rotunda, which is the central building at the University of Virginia. And Joseph Carrington Cabell, perhaps even more important because Jefferson urges him to become a member of the Virginia legislature, and he carries his water, as you would say, and helps pass these bills, and he becomes Jefferson's great political supporter in the Virginia state legislature.
And what do we know about the early curriculum at Central College?
Well, it was pretty radical, and you'd have to say pretty liberal, and what was unheard of at the time is the students chose their own classes. So as opposed to William & Mary, which technically is an Anglican school, and kids are going to be told what they have to learn, here they come and they get a menu and they get to pick. People at the time thought that was way too radical. It's way too liberal. Another thing that people should remember about Thomas Jefferson, a radical liberal. And they didn't think it would succeed. Oh, my gosh, that's just too crazy. Let the kids pick?
Wow.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Was it expensive?
It was expensive. It was very expensive. In fact, it was more expensive than most anything else that was in existence at the time early on. So it's more expensive than Harvard. It's more expensive than Yale. It's a lot more expensive than William & Mary. One of the things, and it's not in my chapter on my book about Jefferson on the founding of the University of Virginia, but I use it in my tour. One of the things that really bothered him, and one of the reasons he was pushing so hard for a great institution of higher learning in the South, is that prior to the establishment of the University of Virginia, the sons of plantation owners in the South, to get a good education, had to go either to the mid-Atlantic states or, worse yet, and remember, this is from Jefferson's point of view, worse yet, to New England, where they're being taught not Republican principles, and I'm talking Jeffersonian Republican principles,
right,
but Federalist principles. Federalist Party is the party that despises Thomas Jefferson. And so kids who are going to Harvard and Yale, they're learning Federalist principles. That really, really bothers Thomas Jefferson.
Historian Rick Britton is here in our studio this morning. We're talking about the founding of the University of Virginia as it celebrates its 200th anniversary this year. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. All right, Joseph Carrington Cabell.
Yes.
Important guy, friend of Jefferson. Talk about his role in moving this thing forward to establishing a university.
Well, he's the great proponent of Jefferson's ideals in the state university. And there's a great letter he writes to Thomas Jefferson saying, you know, I got this great idea. I've just done the grand tour of Europe. And by the way, I'm a fellow alum of William & Mary, and I know something of the law like you do, Mr. Jefferson. I got this great idea for a museum somewhere in Virginia, and maybe you could help me found this wonderful museum, maybe in Richmond. And Jefferson writes him back and says, if you're well-educated and you've done the grand tour, why waste your time founding a museum? Go into the legislature. So Jefferson is like telling him what he should do with the rest of his life. Go into the, and this is kind of typical, Thomas, go into the legislature and help me found a university and help me found one that will be, that will make the state of Virginia proud. Why devote your life to this other silly little ideal? Let's do this instead.
So he does. So this is the thinking big again, right?
Thinking big.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why waste your time on a museum?
Seriously, dude.
I guess. Get with it.
So this is the same Cabell Hall, I assume.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So this Joseph Carrington Cabell, he had a big influence on the whole process once Jefferson brought him over.
Right. So he gets into the legislature. So he gets into the legislature pretty easily. And so, like I said, he's the guy carrying Jefferson's water, helping him pass, getting these bills passed, and helping, we'll talk about the Rockfish Gap Commission, I imagine, soon, helping get Jefferson and Madison on the Rockfish Gap Commission. And what's really fascinating is that at one point in the process, he gets weary. And he says, you know, Mr. Jefferson, he writes him a letter. Mr. Jefferson, this fight is really tough. And I have to admit, it's tougher than I thought it was going to be. So I think I'm going to move on and maybe just read and write for the rest of my life, and kind of enjoy myself. Jefferson lets him have it. Jefferson writes back and says, you know, one of the most painful thing in life is to be deserted by your friends.
Low blow.
I don't know about you, but this is a valuable fight. And I intend, and this is a direct quote, I intend to die in the last ditch.
Wow.
What about you?
So Jefferson was really dedicated to this idea.
And shames this poor guy. Yeah. Can you imagine receiving that kind of letter from Thomas Jefferson?
Yeah, really. I mean,
I'm going to die in the last ditch.
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, two-term president. I mean, this is not just your neighbor. This is somebody who, you know, holy cow. So now these guys and others move on to getting the university established.
Right.
Why did William and Mary kick up such a fuss about this?
Oh, well, that's a fascinating story. So we get to the point where Central College, the buildings are going up, all those beautiful brick buildings with all those beautiful classical, neoclassical facades. And the legislature decides, okay, well, you know what? We're going to put together a commission, and that's the Rockfish Gap Commission that I just mentioned, to decide what institution in Virginia is going to be the University of Virginia. So Jefferson and Cabell make sure that Jefferson and Madison are members of this commission, which meets up in Rockfish Gap, ergo the name. William and Mary is one of the contenders. Why? Well, they've been around since the 1600s. They think they're already the University of Virginia. So it's a minor technicality for them, to them, to just get the name.
Right.
The University of Virginia.
Right.
And the reason I keep saying that is because for people around here, UVA is the university. When you say the university, it's UVA.
Right.
Washington College in Lexington already existed. Today's Washington and Lee. And they had a benefactor who was willing to give them a lot of money. And I forget offhand, I think it's about another $50,000 to help them grow. And there was also a committee in Stanton. And they wanted to build in Stanton the University of Virginia. So what's fascinating to me about this story is this is a real highbrow commission, and they're talking about a highbrow ideal. Where is the University of Virginia going to be? And yet they're meeting in this old tavern in Rockfish Gap. I just find this amusing.
Right.
They're sitting on these old broken bottom chairs in a log structure atop of this rough-hewn kind of wooden table. That's where they're meeting. And I just find that really fascinating. So it comes time for Jefferson to give his presentation. And, of course, he's going to argue that Central College should be the University of Virginia. So he wrote in one of his letters that the biggest part of his luggage to get up there to Rockfish Gap was this huge cardboard map of Virginia. So I love this story. So here are these guys sitting around this table. So Jefferson stands up and he flops down this huge cardboard map. And with the map, he proves that not only is Charlottesville closer to the geographic center of Virginia, but of all the different contenders, it's also the closest to the population center of Virginia. And after all, if you're going to have a university, the University of Virginia, you want it to be equidistant for the most people to travel to from Virginia. And then he has these... this is a hilarious part of the story. He has these affidavits. He's got lists of and affidavits from octogenarians. That's people 80 years old plus living in Albemarle County. This is a direct slap at William and Mary. I can just see when once he pulls out these lists and starts passing them around, and affidavits from people saying, you know, I've lived here my entire life. And it's a salubrious climate. They used to use words like that back then, salubrious. The problem, the reason it's a slap at William and Mary is everybody understood William and Mary's on the Virginia Peninsula, and there's marshland, there's swampland right nearby. And everybody understood that there was a good chance if you went down there and spent time that you would get sick. And a lot of students went there and got sick and didn't come home from the College of William and Mary. They thought it was the vapors coming up off the marsh. They had a name for it. They called it miasmic vapors. What they would learn, and what it took a UVA medical school grad to prove to the world, that person's name was Walter Reed. It's the mosquitoes.
Right.
Propagating in that marshland, that they're the vector delivering all kinds of diseases. So this is a direct slap. Basically, he's saying, make my Central College west of Charlottesville, the University of Virginia, send your students here, and they're going to be healthy.
So it's January 25th, 1819. The big day finally comes for Jefferson and Cabell and...
In
Central College.
Yep.
The Virginia Assembly grants the papers,
the charter,
to found the university. And Cabell writes to Jefferson and basically says, this is ours, buddy. Nobody's going to take it. Right?
He does. He says, now we have got the ground and nobody can take it from us.
Wow. Yeah. That must have been a huge moment. Huge moment.
Can you hear the champagne cork in the background?
But what was the significance of that moment from outside of the elite group?
Yeah. Okay. So here's what it meant. It really meant that they could tap into more of the literary fund. So it meant more monies for building better structures at the University of Virginia. That's what it really meant.
Cool.
Yeah.
Historian Rick Britton here in our studio this morning. We're talking about the founding of the University of Virginia as it celebrates its 200th anniversary this year. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Stream us live online at 947wpvc.org or on your mobile device via TuneIn. After the break, more on the founding of Mr. Jefferson's University. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. We're back with historian Rick Britton talking about the founding of the University of Virginia. So they get the charter. They've got Central College as a kind of a core now.
Right.
And so where do we go from there?
Well, now it's the University of Virginia.
Now,
so now we've made it to the last incarnation.
Right. Talk about some of the people who participated in developing that architecture. You've mentioned that Jefferson was big on this. Were there other influences on the architecture?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Jefferson's great architectural mentor, the man from whom he got the idea for Monticello, and he goes back to this architectural mentor when he starts designing the buildings of the University of Virginia, and that was 16th century Italian architect Andrea Palladio. And what Palladio had done is, in his four books of architecture that Jefferson, that came out in the, there was a new edition that Jefferson had that came out right around the time of Jefferson's birth, 1742, 1743. The four books of architecture Jefferson called his architectural Bible. What Palladio had done is had gone around and he had sketched, and he provides the sketches, detailed sketches, of extant Roman ruins in Western Europe. But the important thing is with the dimensions. So if you wanted to reproduce the exact forms of all those different orders of Greek and Roman architecture, now you had the manual of exactly how to do that. So Jefferson goes back to Palladio in designing the University of Virginia, and there are plenty of Palladian influences that you see. But then he also writes to the man who happens to be working on the U.S. Capitol at the time, and that's a well-known architect by the name of Benjamin Latrobe. And so this is a not well-known story about the university in the fact that Latrobe sends him some sketches, some proposals for the lawn and for a central building. And if you see this one sketch that shows a large central building towering over the other buildings on the lawn, and you see the look of that round central building, you realize that perhaps Jefferson had not come up with the idea for the rotunda himself, that he actually got it from Benjamin Latrobe.
Right. And there were also Greek practices in the education itself, right?
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about that, the students and the professors. And
yeah, so in a nod to the Greek practices of education, Jefferson organizes the lawn so that the pavilions, each pavilion, which pavilion is a two-story structure, and there are 10 of them on the lawn, each was a department in the university. So, for example, ancient languages, modern languages, natural science. The professors would live upstairs. They teach their classes downstairs. So the upstairs is an apartment for the professor and his family. Downstairs is the classroom. And then the east and the west lawns are connected by 54 student rooms behind the colonnades, each one designed. Nowadays, they're just for one student, but each one was originally designed for two students. So he's got accommodations on the lawn itself, east and west lawn, for 108 students. So here is the similarity to Greek educational practices. The teachers and the students are gathered together, not just intellectually, but physically in a proximity.
And talk just briefly about the lawn itself and how that, you know, it's a classic. When you think of the University of Virginia, you immediately think of the lawn. Was that Jefferson's idea? And how does that tie all the architecture together?
There's also a possibility that it was not Jefferson's idea. And I have seen, so don't quote me on this. So it's just an idea that you gave me when you asked me that question. I have seen over the past few decades sketches of famous hospitals in Western Europe that had also been drawn up on that same plan. So in other words, it's a number of buildings around a central open space. The lawn at the University of Virginia is almost 2 acres. It's terraced in three terraces. That's Jefferson's design. You mentioned Cabell Hall just a few minutes ago, but I want the listeners to understand that in Jefferson's idea, the south end of the lawn opposite the rotunda sits at the north end, was not to be sealed off. So the three buildings, including Cabell Hall at the southern end of the lawn, were designed by Stanford White, one of the most famous architects of the late 1800s. early 20th century, and he sealed off the bottom of the lawn. So that's not by Jefferson's design.
Talk a little bit about the construction of the university, just with some rough milestones as to terms of dates and accomplishments.
So
when did it begin?
Okay, so the first cornerstone laying is October in 1817. So by the time they get the charter, a number of the pavilions and a number of the buildings on the lawn are already going up. You might wonder about the bricks. Listeners might know that this soil that we have in Central Virginia, this red clay soil, is perfect for bricks. So a brick kiln was built over where Alderman Library is nowadays, and this one brick kiln provided most of the bricks. Now, as to the labor itself was done by slaves. Now, they're being supervised by white supervisors. So Jefferson brought in two men who had worked, Irishmen who had worked on Monticello, and that's Nielsen and, I'm having a senior moment, Dan, and the name escapes me, but he brings them in, and they become supervisors, and then, of course, he also hires white bricklayers and white carpenters, but the physical labor itself is being done by slaves, most of whom were rented from local plantation owners.
So they weren't all Jefferson's slaves?
No, in fact, as far as I know, none of them were Jefferson's slaves.
Oh, is that right?
So they're hired from the plantation owners, yeah.
Right. And we talked earlier about Jefferson's role in the surveying of the university. When it came time to build it, was he also a hands-on kind of guy?
Yeah. Well, he designed all the buildings himself.
I'm thinking more about the construction. Was he like an on-site supervisor, you know, kind of making sure that they...
Not so much. No. Not so much. No. But he is drawing up the plans and then handing them to the supervisors. And I know that I know from my experience at Monticello that it must have also been at this time with the University of Virginia very frustrating, because Jefferson had a habit of giving them measurements that were 3 and 4 digits below the period. So to a carpenter who, you know, is about to saw something in two,
right,
that could be very frustrating when he realizes that he might not be able to do it to Mr. Jefferson's very exacting specifications.
Sure.
So I know it must have been very frustrating. So they were actually probably relieved when he was not on site.
So does history record the names of the people who kind of, what we would call a general contractor today?
History does record it, and unfortunately I do not have that that information with me. But for the Papers of Thomas Jefferson Retirement Series, I have drawn maps of the original grounds of the University of Virginia, and so that's in the Papers of Thomas Jefferson, that map. And I probably should have brought a copy with me, and I'm sorry, but we had extra space, so we included the names of all the different bricklayers, all the different carpenters. There were also plasterers. I mean, you name it, painters.
Sure.
Yeah.
All the trades.
All the different trades.
Of the time.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. Historian Rick Britton here in our studio this morning. We are talking about the founding of the University of Virginia as it celebrates its 200th anniversary this year. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Okay, it's a big university, needs lots of money. Where does the funding come from to get going?
So initially they had an endowment, and we're talking initially when it was Central College. They were able to, as Central College, tap into a percentage of the literary fund. But then later on, once they get the charter as the University of Virginia, they're able to tap into more state funds. And then, of course, they also have people who are endowing the university, people who are granting money for this very ambitious project to go up. And there's a really humorous story. The legislature complained a lot because the buildings were very expensive. And they're very expensive because they're very beautiful.
Right.
And so they would complain to Jefferson through Cabell, Mr. Jefferson, you know, why do we need these kinds of buildings at the University of Virginia? And he had a pat answer that he used a number of different times, and it's just perfect. And you can just see Thomas Jefferson. He goes, look, for our professors, we want the best characters. And I don't mean characters in the modern, the best professors.
Sure.
Good wasn't good enough for Jefferson. It had to be great or the best.
Right.
We want the best professors. And then, of course, we're going to attract the best students. We can't get the best professors if we expect them to teach in a barn. He used that phrase a lot, in a barn. So in other words, we want the best professors. We have to put up the best buildings to attract. Because after all, what else is there in tiny little Charlottesville, Virginia? And the answer is nothing. There's nothing else to attract those people to this part of Virginia. It better be great architecture, great curriculum, great grounds, a great university. It better be that. Otherwise, who's going to come?
That all makes so much sense.
Right.
And in fact, modern companies today use the same technique. They don't have beautiful buildings, but they have, you know,
all kind of amenities.
Amenities and a campus and, you know,
yeah,
all that stuff.
Free daycare.
Yeah, for the same reason.
Right, exactly.
Because they want
the best people.
Yeah, sure.
And so far, like, for example, you can see the people in the legislature after Jefferson, you know, lectures them that way going, well, okay. And then he asks for $50,000 for the rotunda. That's one building.
Wow.
$50,000. And imagine how much $50,000 was in those days.
Wow. I wanted to talk a little bit about the rotunda.
Uh-huh.
It's clearly the university's most iconic building.
It is.
You mentioned earlier that not necessarily Jefferson's design completely.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So, again, the basis of the architecture for the rotunda was Greek?
No, it's actually Roman.
Roman, okay.
So the rotunda is a half-scale version of the Pantheon in Rome.
Oh, half-scale?
Half-scale.
Wow.
So to understand, and as an engineer, Dan, you'll get a kick out of this. So Jefferson writes that it's half-scale, therefore it has one-quarter the footprint and one-eighth the volume.
Right. Awesome. Talk about the books. The rotunda was the original library,
right,
of the university.
In the dome room was the library.
In the dome room. Right. Talk about the library. Where did most of the books come from?
So Jefferson, as you probably already know, is an amazingly eclectic reader, and he reads in seven languages. So it's a very eclectic library, much like his library at Monticello that he had sold after the burning of Washington, D.C. to help reestablish the Library of Congress. So it's incredibly eclectic. A large portion of it is going to be the history of North America and lots of languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, Greek, Latin. A lot of books on the law and a lot of books on the known sciences at the time.
And did Jefferson live to see the rotunda completed?
That's a great question, because the answer is no, unfortunately. The rotunda was not completed until September of 1826, and as everybody knows, Jefferson passed away on the 4th of July, 1826, 50 years to the day after the adoption of the Declaration of Independence.
Wow, yeah. I want to ask you about the early educators at the university. Were they American? Were they drawn from other countries? How were they recruited?
You ask great questions, my friend. No, this was an early on frustration that Jefferson and the other movers and shakers at UVA had. They couldn't get the best characters here in the United States, so they ended up going abroad. And this created a problem that we can talk about in a moment. But so, for example, when UVA first opens its doors in 1825 for the first session. They hadn't filled out 10 departments. They only had 8 departments. Of the 8 departments, 6 of the professors were foreigners. Now, this creates a problem, and actually creates a big problem, because early on in the history of the University of Virginia, the students were, a polite word to use actually is riotous, and they had riots where they complained about the European professors.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. And some of the professors were, I mean, they were good. One in particular, whose name was Bladerman, who was teaching modern languages, he was fairly notorious, and he ends up leaving the University of Virginia. He actually, it's a really sad story, he actually chased his wife out onto the lawn with a bullwhip.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing the stuff that gets written down.
It's amazing.
I want to ask you about the legacy of the university. What part of Jefferson's UVA legacy still survives today? What do we think about when we look at the university today that came from Jefferson? Certainly the architecture.
Well, the most obvious thing, of course, is the architecture. The Rotunda is considered by American architects one of the most beautiful buildings in the United States. The dome room upstairs on the third floor, one of the most beautiful rooms in the United States. But when you consider that the university and Monticello are both on the UNESCO United Nations World Heritage List. And what that means is, everybody says that, but nobody says what it means. What it means is those buildings, those structures are to be preserved at all cost, no matter the cost. Some of the other structures on that UNESCO United Nations World Heritage List are things like the Great Wall of China, the Taj Mahal, and when you consider that here in Charlottesville, we have 2 of those places, that's just amazing. And they're both because of the same man.
I know, it's mind-boggling.
It
really
is totally.
Isn't it?
It's
really
totally mind-boggling. Yeah. But then, aside from the architecture, of course, there's the great educational legacy. And when you consider that, you know, President Woodrow Wilson is a graduate of the law school of the University of Virginia. Both of the younger Kennedy brothers, graduates of law school. Now, I haven't done this, but I am positive that if you went and you tried to figure out how many U.S. senators, how many congressmen over the course of UVA's 200-year history had been educated at the University of Virginia, it would be a very large number. And that's just in the law. Then there's the amazing medical school, the amazing architectural school, which is so appropriate that we should have it here, because Jefferson, after all, was a self-trained architect. When you think that he did those amazing things and he self-taught, that's another amazing thing about Thomas Jefferson. But then, of course, going down to our immediate area, the millions and millions and millions of dollars every year that's pumped into our local economy, thanks to the University of Virginia. Charlottesville, without the University of Virginia, would be just another backwater Virginia town.
Sure, sure. And not only does it bring that prestige to this, but it's a source of stable employment.
Right.
You know, so we can have this beautiful town that's not laden with heavy industry.
Exactly.
Because of Jefferson's University brings this money from outside.
And we haven't even mentioned the culture. Now we have a very cosmopolitan atmosphere.
Sure.
In a fairly small Central Virginia town. Where else are you going to find that?
Wow. Rick, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thanks today. For having me.
This is great. So what have you got coming up on your palette of things to do?
Holy cow. To celebrate the 200th anniversary of the University of Virginia at the center in October and November, I'm going to have a 6-session class on the founding and the early years of the University of Virginia.
Wow. And where will that be?
So that'll be at the center, formerly the Senior Center.
Right.
And the announcement is going to come out just in the next couple of weeks. So there'll be more information. So they can go to thecenterseville.org to get information.
And will there be an on-site component of that as well? Will you be taking the class over to the
Absolutely.
Over to the university?
The travel session at the very end will be a free tour by me of the original grounds of the University of Virginia.
Cool. And when does that start again?
So it starts in October of this year.
Right. And is there a fee for that?
Yeah, there'll be a fee. It's probably going to be around $80, $90 for a six-session class and a free tour.
It's a great deal.
It is a great deal. Thank you, sir.
It's a great deal.
It is.
If you want to sign up, how do you sign up?
So it's being offered through the travel office at the center, formerly the senior center. So people can call down to the travel office, and it's 434-974-6538.
And I was going to ask you, do they have to go to the senior center to pay? Can they pay online?
They can pay. They can actually pay online, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, Rick, thanks so much for stopping by and sharing this momentous occasion, 200 years, the University of Virginia. We really appreciate you stopping by and sharing your vast knowledge on the subject.
Thanks for having me.
Historian Rick Britton here in our studio this morning. We've been talking about the founding of the University of Virginia as it celebrates its 200th anniversary this year. This and every episode of The Wake Up Call is available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Join us next Sunday at 11 a.m. when Rick Moore returns to the anchor chair with another interesting guest. Coming up at noon on 94.7 WPVC, it's El Club del Sabor. For The Wake Up Call, I'm Dan Gould. Thanks for listening.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.